history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories out there that you don't want to miss out on. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we take that journey, we end up learning a whole lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today, I'm in San Luis Obispo, California, with 99-year-old Vic Freudenberger. He's going to turn 100 at the end of January, and they're planning a big celebration for him here at Las Brisas, where he makes his home in San Luis Obispo. But Vic, I want to talk about Philadelphia in the 20s and 30s, because you were growing up.
Right.
I imagine that childhood was a little different from what most people experience now. What are the things you remember about way back when?
Well, growing up, of course, it was a big city, and I enjoyed it, and I enjoyed in the winter. We'd go ice skating and out on the ponds and all in the parks. I lived with my grandparents and my mother. My grandfather had a lot of relatives, and one of them owned a home in Wildwood, New Jersey. We'd always go down there every summer and spend a couple of weeks. They had a big home, which just had rentals for homes for vacation. So that's where I learned to enjoy the water. So I had an aunt that lived in a little town called Woodcrest, New Jersey, which is near Haddonfield. And I'd spend time there in the summer with a bunch of young fellows that lived there. And so we had a great experience. We'd go swimming in the creek and walk all the way from 3 miles to Haddonfield, where they had a public pool. And we'd walk the railroad track 3 miles up and swim free and come back again. So we did a lot of walking in those days. So that's the way I grew up.
Do you remember having an ambition, a dream, that thought that some boys do of, hey, when I grow up, here's what I'm going to do with my life?
Well, no, I hadn't really thought about it. What happened is I read a book by a famous Marine who started with the Boxer Rebellion and went all through the World War One and all, and she 2 medals of honor. And so I was kind of impressed by the Marine Corps, by this story. So I figured, well, why not try it? So I, on my own, just decided to enlist. And at the time, there were only 17,000 total in the Marine Corps, 1938. They always said there were more policemen in New York City police force than there were in the Marine Corps. So when they talk about the old Marine Corps, that was it. So I went through boot camp in Parris Island, and then I went to sea school in Norfolk, Virginia for 3 or 4 weeks. So I knew I'd be going aboard a ship, which was great because I wanted to travel. That was part of the incentive. My first tour of duty was aboard a new cruiser, the Wichita, heavy cruiser Wichita, which was built in Philadelphia, incidentally, and was commissioned in January of 39. I was assigned as a captain's orderly, which was a pretty choice job because wherever the captain went, you were with him. And so anyway, I was that assignment for over 2 years. Being a new ship, you knew it'd be no transfer for 2 years. But just about that time, the parachutists came into being, that the commandant decided he wanted paratroopers.
You know, to be a paratrooper, you have to volunteer. What possessed you to volunteer for that?
Well, as I said, it sounded interesting. And of course, the $55 a month was an incentive, too. So anyway, I just decided it'd be kind of fun to try it. So I volunteered and was accepted, and I went to Lakehurst, New Jersey, and that's where the original training was at the beginning. We had 6 weeks training there, which included 6 jumps to qualify you. We had very strenuous training, lots of running and calisthenics and all, so we were starting out to be in pretty good physical shape.
You know, I'm just curious. You told me, you know, you grew up in Philadelphia, and I know you were selling magazines and papers to earn some money as a boy, so you couldn't play sports in high school. You were too busy with that.
Right.
You never knew your father, your mother, and your grandparents raised you. Had you ever been on an airplane before you were jumping out of airplanes with the Marine Corps?
I don't think I was. I really don't think I was, now that you mention it.
That's kind of unique, isn't it? The first airplane you ever went in, you jumped out of.
Right, that's true.
Were you at all nervous about any of that, the jumping idea?
Well, there's a separate story I would like to include if you want to.
You're the boss.
The day before we were to make our first jump at Lakehurst, there had already been a platoon. The first platoon, the first group that were already established in San Diego, designated as a second parachute battalion. They were making a jump, and the jump went along fine. But at the end, of the officer, Lieutenant Osipov, was the last to go out, and they normally would throw out the cargo also. So when he tossed out the cargo and the static line, which is something that the static line would automatically, you clip onto the static line in the plane,
right,
and then your main chute is pulled open automatically. Well, when he went out, the static line pulled out, and it went out, and he was entangled with the cargo and the static line. And the cargo chute cleared, but he was tailing behind the plane. The plane had no radio contact, so they're flying over the area and not knowing how to. If they landed, of course, he'd be killed.
So he's still entangled, so he's getting dragged behind the plane?
He's being dragged behind the plane.
And there's actually a photograph of him, Walter Osipov.
So a Navy pilot and another man flew on an open cockpit plane, and they flew up and were able to rescue him, but they had to get so close to get him clear of the plane that actually the propellers took a portion of the DC-3. That's how close it was. And the interesting part was that we found it at the same time in Lakehurst. We got it on the radio and we heard this all going on.
Oh, wow.
And so we were making our own first jump the next day. So needless to say, we were, what should we say, scared.
Yeah, that's not very reassuring.
Very apprehensive, let's say. So it was the first time that, and the only time that ever happened.
But they got him safely out of there.
Right, it was quite amazing. Anyway, just to recap, I made a total of about 40 jumps.
So you train there in New Jersey, and then more in North Carolina, what we know now as Camp Lejeune. And that's where you were when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor.
That's right.
Now this is real. You're going to be going to war.
Yeah, right. So as I said, we started doing even more extensive training than we had by spending the whole week, Monday to Friday, in the field, getting a lot of specialized training, creep and crawling, knife fighting, lots of things that the paratroopers were designed to do. So the Army held the first big rehearsal. Of course, the paratroopers wanted to get involved with it, but there was only one plane available, and they actually jumped and acted as, and were very successful in cutting communication lines and all that. I was in a group with the A Company, Captain Torgerson, so he decided he'd bring us in, and we actually went in by truck, went ahead and had fun for a while, but found out right away that we weren't authorized to do that. So but anyway, it was kind of fun while it lasted. So, but anyway, that was an interesting experience, and that was just about a month before we left. As I say, we left in May through the canal and to Wellington, New Zealand. And the other half came on a large ship from the West Coast. They literally starved to death on the way. The food was so terrible, and they got two meals a day. And they were really out of shape when they got to New Zealand, because that's a long trip. It's about 30 days, you know.
So you got the better straw on that one.
We were really very fortunate in that respect. In fact, so then by the time they got there, we had already received the word that we were going to offload and then combat load. So combat meant that the ammunition goes on the ship, which, what if it's infantry, artillery, tanks, that ammunition had to be on the ship with them. So that's combat loading. And so it rained constantly the whole time we were there. And the group from the West Coast got there about a week after we did. And as soon as we loaded and we took off and prepared to make this landing, and we didn't know until we got underway to where we were going. This is Solomon Islands, and the large island was called Guadalcanal, and there's another island called Gavutu and Tanambogo, joined by a causeway. Another island called Tulagi. The Marines also had what they call raider battalions, who were also specially trained, about the same as we, only they didn't jump. So they landed at the same time the main division portion landed in Guadalcanal. They landed in Tulagi. But we didn't get into Gavutu until after 12 o'clock because of shortage of, there weren't enough Higgins boats to land us all simultaneously.
So here you spent all this time training
right.
to be paratroopers.
That's right.
You're not going to jump in.
That's right.
And now by the time you get there, it's about 4 hours after the initial invasion, which didn't meet a lot of resistance.
That's right.
But now the enemy knows you're there and
they're
you're coming.
Your voodoo was an island was quite small, but it had a hill about 300 feet in height, and the whole hill was just full of caves where they could come out and fire and get right back, and it was very hard. Did not offer very many targets. When we landed, we were under fire from there and also from Tanambogo.
And you didn't get right up to the shore. You had to wade in for a ways.
That's right. Our Higgins boat ran aground about 100 yards out. And so we landed about 100 yards. We had to go in under. We were in fairly deep water, as I said, to some of the shorter fellows. I was 6'2" at the time, and it was all up to my chest. So there were ones carrying ammunition and weapons, and some of them was fortunate they didn't drown because they were really in a precarious situation. So anyway.
And you're getting shot at already 100 yards off?
We were getting shot at, yes. We were receiving fire that far out. So my assistant squad leader was in ahead of me because he was in the front of the Higgins boat where we landed, and I was in the back of it. So he landed before I did, and he was killed instantly. So he got to the, he only got about 50 feet in and was killed. And the arrangement was that we were the A company. We were supposed to go in and move in about 100 yards, and then the B company would come in and follow up. So we were the first to land also. So we received full fire. In the course of the day, out of the 400 men who landed, we had 30 killed and over 100 wounded, which is pretty severe casualties.
And that includes you.
That included me. It was about 2 hours, 2 to 3 hours, when mortar fire from Tanambogo, one of their rounds landed close to me and another man.
And I want to hear about that, but I'm curious, Vic. I know you've told this story for a long time. You're going to turn 100 years old here in January, and you've been telling this story since 1942, one way or another. But if you can go back to that, I guess, 22-year-old kid who's coming ashore there in August of 42, you're a squad leader. You're responsible for these other guys. And before you even get ashore, your second in command is killed.
Killed, right. Mm-hmm.
I can't imagine you'd ever been through anything that could prepare you for that. So how did you react? How did that hit you in that moment?
Well, I mean, I'm sure there wasn't anything you could do about it. You went in and using the training, we at least got in as far as we could and attempted to find an area where we were what they call in defile, where they couldn't fire directly down on us. So I didn't have any of the other, my squad wounded until this mortar fire started. And I think I was probably the second or third wounded. Oh, I take that back. There were a couple because I, using this rising gun, which I was very, very faulty. It would not fire. It was given to us only a couple of weeks before we left, and it wasn't time enough to realize how inaccurate and it would jam on any water or sand. The spring, it was a 45 caliber semi-automatic, but the spring was not strong enough, so it would misfire constantly. In fact, mine was, I never was able to fire a shot of it. So,
and, wasn't but it was so, given to you because they thought if you're jumping out of a plane, you need something lighter than a big, heavy Springfield rifle?
That's right, that's why we were given them. It was because of that. Also, there was another weapon, the Johnson, a man by the name of Johnson had developed a rifle and a semi-automatic. And Captain Torgerson, the company commander, had contacted them, and he and several of them actually paid their own money because the weapon was so reliable. Mm-hmm. And, of course, that weapon was used all the way through and was excellent, but the service never did accept it or develop it, but the paratroopers carried it at all times, and it was two perfect weapons, both the rifle and the semi-automatic. So it wasn't until another one of my men was wounded that I took his Springfield rifle, which again was our basic weapon, and squad has also two Browning automatic rifles, which they were also very dependable. So we did have some firepower. But the O3 and the BAR and the few that had the Johnson rifle and submachine gun were able ones to put up a good defense, so to speak. So after I was wounded, I was treated by a corpsman. And
well, tell me about how you got wounded. So you're there for a few hours.
Yeah.
You're seeing guys killed and wounded around you.
Right.
You're trying to find something to fire at, but it's hard because they're hiding in caves and they
That's
have
right.
the higher ground.
That's right.
And then all of a sudden, this mortar fire starts coming in from the neighboring island, Tanimbogo. They're connected by that causeway, this narrow strip of
right.
pavement, as you talked about.
Right.
And so now mortar fire's coming in.
Mm-hmm.
What can you do about that?
Well, you can't do anything about it. Mortar fire is very effective. It's they had what they called a knee mortar. Their mortar was a small one, but it was effective because the one that landed in which I was wounded from, also there was another man next to me. He was actually, he died from the wounds.
Meacham,
yeah.
So the mortar hits between the two of you?
Between the two of us. And he got the major portion of it. We knew he was seriously wounded. He was unconscious and was taken down right to the waiting for the first boat, but still took another hour or two before we were evacuated.
It's time for our first commercial break, but we'll hear about the extent of Vic's injuries when we come back. Vic Freudenberger, 99 years old and turning 100 in a matter of weeks. There is much more to come with this 22-year veteran of the Marine Corps when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Put $250 in a savings account and you'll start earning dividends. Who else is going to do that for you? And access? So easy. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Again, the website myeecu.org, or just pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with 99-year-old Vic Freudenberger of San Luis Obispo, California, originally from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. He enlisted in the Marine Corps in 1938 and spent some time aboard the cruiser USS Wichita before volunteering for paratrooper duty. The Marines had never had paratroopers before, and he became one of the first. Now, to his knowledge, he's the last member of that first parachute battalion still living. After all that airborne training, Vic's first taste of combat came in a battle where he had to head in on a Higgins boat, leading his squad in the initial landing on Gavutu as part of the Battle of Guadalcanal in August 1942. The boat got hung up and couldn't make it all the way to shore, and his assistant squad leader was killed before Vic even made it in. A couple hours later, a mortar shell landed between Vic and a fellow Marine.
I was hit in the leg, and one large piece of fragment was about an inch long, and it lodged directly into my heel, into the bone. And it was actually large enough, it was protruding out from the heel of my boot. And so the corpsman, of course, took the boot off and we tried to move the fragment, but it was lodged in the bone. And so naturally it was pretty painful. What they always do, they give you a shot and morphine, and then they also give you a shot of, I'll try to remember.
Penicillin or
tetanus shot.
Tetanus stuff for the metal.
Yes.
Yeah. But you can't walk, obviously.
I couldn't walk on it, no. It was very painful. So I, with assistance and the corpsman, got me down to the beach where the wounded were waiting to be evacuated. Later in the afternoon, we were put aboard an APA. We, of course, were all in cots below decks. And the next day, the Japanese came in with about 20 bombers. And we could hear the bombing going on. And we knew that they were trying to get the ships. And fortunately, the Navy was prepared and shot practically all of them down. But then the second night, the Japanese Navy came in and completely surprised the U.S. Navy. Three cruisers were sunk, three American cruisers and one Australian cruiser. So the Navy was completely devastated by that. The Admiral decided he had to leave because there were only three aircraft carriers in the whole Pacific at that time. And so he decided to leave, and that was before half of the equipment and the ammunition and food had been unloaded. So when they left the division there completely on their own, no aircraft or supporting them. And ammunition and food were, half of them were still aboard the Navy ships. And so they were completely at their mercy. So it took about 2 weeks before support aircraft came in. In the meantime, they were receiving fire. Submarines would come up and fire directly at them in the daytime. And at night, the cruisers and all would come in and bomb. And they'd receive bombing from the daytime. And also at night, they'd receive firing from the ships. So they were under fire practically the whole time.
So the reality for you was?
I was fortunate enough that I had been wounded.
Yeah, you were a lot better off where you were than
had
you still been on Guadalcanal.
So I was very fortunate in that respect. And so I went back to had a newly formed Naval Hospital, Mobile Hospital, they called. So we were the first patients that they had. As I said, when we were coming over from the States to New Zealand, we were given two shots for a tetanus shot.
Yeah.
So we received two tetanus shots. When I was wounded, I was given another one, which was okay, that was three. When I got aboard the APA, the next day, they gave me another shot, and trying to tell them that I already had three, but they said, well, no record of it. So I received a fourth shot. And then about a week later, we were transferred to a hospital ship. And when I got on the hospital ship, the doctor was giving me another. And I tried to explain to him, and I'd received four shots. Still did not believe me. So I received a fifth shot. And at that point, my friends who were with other wounded said, I blew up. I became unconscious, and I blew up like a balloon. They said they were afraid I was going to die. And so I was fortunate that I survived that. I had received five shots when two or three were adequate.
Well, and so, you mentioned going back to this newly formed mobile hospital. What did they have to do for you? What could they do for that fragment in your heel?
Well, they did attempt to. The days after I got there, after I got over the, it was 3 or 4 days, I guess, before I survived from the tetanus shot.
Oh, so that was before they could ever operate on your foot?
Before they operated on me.
Uh-huh.
And so the first operation, after that, they said, well, we're sorry, we couldn't get it out. I said, couldn't get it out? No, it's really lodged in your bone. He said, you may never walk on that foot again. I said, please, try again. So the second operation, they did remove it. I kept it as a souvenir. I lost it many years ago, but it was at least an inch long. It was a fairly large piece. And it was a long time that I was still limping on my foot, but I was able to walk. And that was another fortunate that they were able to get it removed, of course.
Well, and I'm always curious. You know, I've talked to guys who were at Pearl Harbor on the 7th and wounded there right at the start of the war before they ever had a chance to fight.
Right.
And your experience wasn't that different. Here you've done all this training, 3 years of training, 4 years of training almost by the time you get to Guadalcanal.
Right.
A few hours of combat, and you're out of commission.
That's right, yeah.
So what was your mindset after that? Did that discourage you and make you not want to go back, or was it the opposite end of the spectrum?
Well, obviously, I knew we were going to continue. So after I left, the parachute battalion joined the Raiders, and the Raiders and the paratroopers had a battle in September, which was a critical battle. It's called Bloody Ridge or Essence Ridge. About 500 men, and together the two battalions held off a regiment for one whole night. The book of the chosen, it's in the book if you want the details of that. Of course, I wasn't there, but...
Right, but this book, for people who are hearing some of this and want to see the big picture,
right,
it's called Battalion of the Damned by James Crist, and it tells the story of the 1st Marine Paratroopers at Gavutu and Bloody Ridge, what you're talking about there in September
right.
of 42.
At the end of the Bloody Ridge in September, there were only about 60 of the battalions still physically able to, either wounded or killed. They were evacuated to... transferred to French Island, Noumea, New Caledonia. So by that time, after I was in the hospital about 6 weeks and then transferred with some of the others to, we were placed in the island of New Caledonia, had an army division there, and right in Noumea. But they sent us out into the about 10 miles out of town to an old base that evidently had been occupied by other troops. The first few nights that we were in the tents, we all were just covered with fleas. It was so bad.
Oof.
That they decided that they burned the whole thing down completely, the tents and the whole thing. So they were so bad. And so anyway, there we are, and yeah, waiting for replacements. Well, there were no replacements coming. The only good part was that we were right by a river, so we could wash and bathe and wash our clothes. I was there about, 8 weeks. Orders came that there were to be 20 of the senior enlisted would become second lieutenants, and 20 would be sent back to the New River, where they now had the school set up, a large school, a parachute school. And so fortunately, I was one of them selected, and so I was, being a sergeant, I was sent back with a close friend of mine. The two of us went back to New River, North Carolina. Were instructors there for about 3-4 months, and that's when the commandant decided that there was no reason to keep the paratroopers any longer, because landing on small islands, which was already established, what's going to happen. He disbanded the paratroopers and also the Raider Battalion. They formed the 3rd Division. They were already in the 2nd Division and then the 3rd. And so at that point, I knew if I'd stay there, I'd be in the division. So I requested to be transferred into ordnance, because I had received training as a demolition technician, and that kind of appealed to me. So I was transferred to Ordnance School in Quantico, Virginia. I had 30-day leave. I was in Philadelphia. I met my wife, or wife-to-be. And
how did that happen? Tell me the story.
Well, we were another sergeant. He convinced me to go on to a dance on Saturday night. It was right in Philadelphia downtown by the City Hall. So I went along with him, even though I wasn't big on dancing. But it so happened that I, near the end of the dance, I saw a beautiful young lady who was just a beautiful person, in my opinion, and very tanned. And so I looked at my friend and I said, I'm going to marry that gal. So before I even met her. So, of course, I introduced myself. And so 4 months later, we were married. And the reason that happened so quickly was that I convinced her that I would have 4 months of school. And then I expected to be sent overseas again, logically. So she surprisingly said yes. And it turned out that we were married for 73 years. Very, very fortunate and just a perfect marriage. And fortunately, she enjoyed the service. And that's why I stayed in at the end of World War II.
Yeah, you stayed in for 22 years in the Marine Corps. But World War II still has some time left. So
You
get married.
So got married. And at the end of my school, I was retained as an instructor. And that was fortunate. So I was instructing demolitions. And in October of 44, I was appointed warrant officer, which was quite unusual because I was only in for 6 years and I was only 24. But anyway, that meant, of course, I was going to be going overseas, but I had to get another 6 weeks or 2 months of training as an ordnance officer. I transferred out to the West Coast, to Camp Pendleton. What they do, they have drafts. The train load had a draft of about 2,500 men from the East Coast. We actually were down in San Diego and ready to go aboard the ships when they pulled us back and sent another draft in place of us. Why, we didn't know, but it was fact that it was, again, we were fortunate. It turned out that, remember, this was in December of 44, the Iwo Jima was February, and so that was, that first draft was the first replacement to go into Iwo Jima. And so I missed Iwo Jima by that, again, fortune. And out of the original battalion who stayed in and became part of the 3rd Division, out of the original 400, there were 96 killed in Iwo Jima from the original battalion.
Wow.
So I was very fortunate again. It seemed like God was taking care of me.
Yeah, there's a pattern developing here.
It really was, yes. And I immediately checked to find out how long it would be in Pendleton before we shipped out again. And they said, you'd probably be here 3 months. So I immediately called my wife, and she was on the train at the same day. And she came out, and I was stationed in what they call Tent Camp 3, which is up north near San Clemente.
Mm-hmm.
So while she's on her way, I was able to fortunately find an apartment right in San Clemente on the ocean, a beautiful home. The way I found it, I checked at a couple of realtors, and they all laughed and said, there's nothing available. There was a motel right on the coast, so that's where I was checking. It so happened as I was walking in the motel, this lieutenant came out from the adjoining home and had a suitcase in his hand. I said, are you leaving? He said, yeah, but you better hurry up because Miss Wirk is going to be driving on the coast to make the apartment available. And so I had to run around. It was on around the corner of the street. And she was actually in the car. And I ran in front of her and said, I'll take it. So again, how lucky can you get? So there's my wife. For 6 weeks, she was able to go swimming every day in January,
yeah,
in February.
Can't do that in Philadelphia.
From Philadelphia. So again, we enjoyed that sojourn. And so then in March, we left and went to Guam. There were no vacancies in this for the ammunition company, so I was assigned as an ordnance officer for a 155 gun, which is the long tom, the heavy, mm-hmm, long rifle. I was the ordnance officer of that. So we were preparing to land. The invasion of Japan was to be October of 45. So we were, of course, training for that. So the fact that the atomic bomb was dropped instead of us going in, the estimated casualties for the first 30 days was to be 1 million casualties because the Japanese had several hundred kamikaze planes. As you probably know, the kamikaze plane was one way they would crash into the most target they could find. And if they'd hit a ship, they could kill hundreds. And so, again, very fortunate that the two bombs caused the end of the war.
But that did not mean his combat experience was over. Vic would end up 5 years later in one of the Korean War's most legendary battles. Vic Freudenberger turns 100 years old at the end of January. They're planning quite a celebration for him at Las Brisas in San Luis Obispo. Thanks, by the way, to Julie Tacker from Las Brisas for letting us know about Vic's story. Check out the photos of Vic then and now at hometownheroesradio.com. or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com. And tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, getting to know a soon-to-be centenarian today. Vic Freudenberger spent more than 22 years in the Marine Corps starting in 1938. We heard about how he was wounded on the first day of the Battle of Guadalcanal in 1942, how coming back to the States allowed him to meet his wife. 2 kids, 5 grandkids, and 7 great-grandkids later, Vic is still going strong. But he had to survive some extreme conditions in the Korean War as well. We left off at the end of World War II. He'd been preparing for the invasion of Japan when the atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki hastened the Japanese surrender.
So I was there on Guam until next year, in January, I was transferred back to Hawaii to the Ordnance Depot. And so I immediately called my wife, and it took her a while to get out because the Navy wasn't providing any transportation. But she came out in March on a Norwegian steamer. So we had a great time and for about 3 months. In June, we received orders to come back to the States. Received orders back to Ordnance School, where I became in charge of the ammunition section. Of course, I was still a warrant officer. I had there for 3 years, which was great because it was like living in a country club. We had horseback riding every Sunday. We had sailing on the river, and the officers' club had a party every Saturday night. So it was like living in a country club. So we had great tour of duty there. Our first daughter was born in December of 46. So we were transferred back to Camp Pendleton to the 1st Division. We were happy about that. By then we decided that California was where we were going to live because of the climate being so wonderful. Got to the 1st Division in January of 1950. We decided to buy a house, but we couldn't find 2-bedroom, 1 house. It was all they had, 1 bath. So there was a new subdivision being built, so we signed up for that. And that was just 2 weeks before Korea popped. And so about February 26th or 27th of 1950, Korea was invaded. The division immediately started preparing to go overseas. But during that time from 1945 to 1950, the Marine Corps had gone from 500,000 down to 60,000, which wasn't, and that's realized, that's scattered all over the country. The 1st Marine Division actually consisted of 1 infantry regiment instead of 3, 1 regiment, 1 battalion of artillery. In other words, it was a third of a division. Mm-hmm. And the same thing was in Camp Lejeune. So in 30 days, fortunately, the Marines had a reserve of about 10,000. So all the reserves were called up to active duty, and they became the 3rd Regiment. It was the 1st, the 5th, and the 7th. So in that short time, the division prepared and went overseas. Well, before the division left, the Korea was almost lost. There was a regiment from Camp Pendleton and what they call a brigade, because it had the regiment and artillery and supporting arms. And they went ahead of time. We loaded them out day and night, working day and night to get them undersea. And they arrived in time to save Korea from being gone, because the way the Army had not prepared, most of the troops from the Army were sent in, which were not even combat troops. A lot of them were just occupational troops who were in Japan, and they were sent in piecemeal. Fortunately, the 5th Marine Regiment, and called the Brigade, was able to hold the line while the rest of the division prepared to make an amphibious landing. So we then went overseas, and September 15th, we landed at Incheon, which was north of where the fighting was going on. And this is a General MacArthur at that time made the decision, and it was a critical thing because the tides in Incheon was a 30-foot tide, which meant that everything had to be done quickly to get in the original amphibious landing. You only had 8 or 9 hours to land, so it went off successfully. Naturally, that wasn't long before 10 days, and the division was already occupying Seoul. And then, of course, MacArthur wanted to keep going, and instead of stopping at the 32nd parallel, he kept going. We went north and all the way on, well into North Korea. Now we're going to jump ahead to November. We were way up in North Korea, and we were capturing Chinese. Even though we were capturing them, MacArthur would not believe that the Chinese were there in force. He kept insisting that the division keep moving north. And, of course, November 27th, 1950, the Chinese had already infiltrated down. And when the Chinese attacked on November 27th, there was estimated 120,000 were surrounding 17,000 of the division. The division was spread out over 70 miles, one-way road in the mountains. It wasn't long before it was 30 degrees below zero. And that's where it was called the Chosen Few. The Chosen Reservoir was in the middle, the main force of the big supply, and that's where I was located with the ammunition company. And of course, I was, in the meantime, had been operating as the division EOD officer. So it was critical that Hagaru would hold, because the two regiments, the 5th and the 7th, were already north and had to fight their way back. It was only 11 miles, but it took them 10 days to get back under constant fire by the Chinese. That's where the fact that the Marine training is different from the Army, because every Marine would retrain for 2 weeks on weapons, their rifles, machine guns, pistols. And so in essence, officers and all enlisted men and officers through lieutenant colonel were trained infantrymen. And so that's what we quickly became, to hold Hagaru, because they would attack every night. In the daytime, if the weather was right, the Air Marine Corps and the Air Force dropping supplies, Hagaru was critical that it had a hold. So we were all infantrymen, and we were receiving airdrops during the day, and then at night the Chinese would attack. So we'd all be on the line, everyone taking charge, realizing this is 30 below zero. So a lot of people were getting severe frostbite, especially the infantry, the two regiments, because they were in the field constantly with little or no protection.
What was the worst thing you had to deal with?
Well, the fact that you were on the line at night, you were only getting a couple hours sleep, you know, you're two of you in a foxhole together. And then in the daytime, we were working to get this ammunition being dropped. So after a few days of that, you just become exhausted. So about the third or fourth day, I've forgotten exactly which, I just became so exhausted I just had to get rest. So I came in the afternoon and to the what they call the warming tent. I had a tent where it was being heated with a small stove. Instead of oil or diesel, we used gasoline, so it would be it would glow red. So I told them, look, I need a couple hours of sleep, and don't bother me. I got to have some rest. Shortly after that, I don't know, an hour or two later, one of the men said, Lieutenant, I was a lieutenant then at that time, they're dropping mortars on our tent. Well, that got my attention. Obviously, the mortars were duds. So I got up, and sure enough, They were using 60-millimeter arm mortars they had captured from when they overran the hill. There was an army unit on the top of what they call East Hill, right where below where we were on the ammunition dump. And they were firing the 60-millimeters at us, but fortunately, they didn't pull the pin. If they had pulled the pin, one mortar would have literally wiped us out.
You wouldn't be here.
We wouldn't be here. Three of them, three duds.
Wow.
So fortunately, they didn't get the word. At that point, you know, you're at such, I said, well, just leave them. And I went back to sleep. You get to that point where, you just accept where you are. And so that was, again, you know, act of God of what, but there were about 10, 12 men in the tent, and they've all been seriously wounded because a 60-millimeter mortar is enough to kill quite a few people.
Well, and I'm just curious, because when a mortar wounded you in Guadalcanal, you were a young single man.
That's right.
When these dud mortars are landing in your tent near the Chosin Reservoir in Korea, you're a husband and a father.
That's right. I was.
How difficult was that? Did you feel different in light of that?
Yeah, you know, you just... Well, you knew you just had to survive, that's all. You know, we never, what should I say, between the Army and the Marine Corps, there's this esprit de corps that you're just not going to surrender. And that's the way it was. In fact, it became known that the Chinese had orders to annihilate the 1st Marine Division. They were not planning to take any prisoners. So it was, you know, fight or die. So that's the way it was. So when the two regiments got back to Hagaroo, there had been an airstrip. The engineers had gotten an airstrip, and they flew out over 3,000 casualties, wounded. So then the next stop was from Hagaroo to Cotterie. That's where the 1st Marine Regiment was. That was another 11 miles further south. And so I and my squad, being the EOD, and fortunately we also had some EOD people, a squad, in the engineer battalion. So we worked together whenever it was a big job. And so we were the last to leave the last night when we were there. Of course, they tried to overrun them. We had one battalion, 2nd Battalion, 5th Marines, and had several tanks. And actually, they did overrun some of the part of the ammunition dump. But fortunately, they say there were two tanks, so I got permission from the CO of the 2nd Battalion to use the fire into the dump. And so firing into an ammunition dump really was effective. The next day, there was hundreds of dead Chinese in the area. And so it took another same way by the time we left. We were the last ones to leave the next day, and it took all day from Hagaroo to Cotterie. I didn't get into there until the next night, very late. And then the following day, we're going to leave Cotterie and head down off the mountain. The same thing happened, and there's a write-up in the other book here about there was a correspondent that was able to fly in. Some flew in from Ham Nung. And he was there, and he decided he wanted to stay and see the dumps blown. And so I told him he couldn't stay with me, that the only way he could stay was if the tankers would accept him. So he did get to the tankers, and they led him to him. So he described the whole operation of blowing the dump at Cotterie. I wasn't even aware of what was going on until years later when the book was written. And my half-brother, who was also in the Marine Corps, same time I was, he was an infantry lieutenant, was enlisted and then became a lieutenant and stayed in, same as I did. He called me and said, you're in this latest book. So I had completely forgotten about this correspondent. And so he wrote up a detailed article about his observation of that. So that's written in the other books, the Korean War from Busan to Chosin.
In your shadow box of medals on the wall by your paratrooper wings and your Purple Heart, I saw a Bronze Star. Is that from that
incident? Yeah, I got the Bronze Star from Korea.
So if you guys hadn't blown the dump, the ammunition dump, what do you think would have happened?
Just made it much more... helped a great deal. I mean, there was no shortage of ammunition, so... we probably would have held out, but the fact that I was able to blow up part of the dump made it, killed a lot of Chinese.
Because you were greatly outnumbered.
Oh, yes, greatly outnumbered. They're fully surrounded.
Yeah.
So, but the daytime, then they pulled back because the aircraft came in and the weather permitting. And when the aircraft came in, then they pulled out because the Marines, particularly with their close air support, they would drop napalm. I was on the hill several times where we got the heat of the napalm. It was that close to us. So if it hadn't been for the air at daytime, we wouldn't have made it. So it was critical that they were able to.
And obviously, I've never done this, and I'm pretty sure most of the people listening have never had to detonate an ammunition dump as a last resort.
Right.
Is there some finesse that's required there? Is there a danger of...
Well, no. There's two ways of doing it. You do it with a fuse, which you light, and you give yourself plenty of time to get away, but not too long, that they can get in. And so what you do, you would triple prime it. Instead of just one charge, you'd put three charges.
Right.
And so out of the three, why? And they were hidden, you see. So you did that so you were sure they were going to go up, to blow up before they can, overcome. But as you hear in the book, we were just over the hill when the charges went off down in Coterie. And same thing when Hagaru. I make sure everybody was gone. That was in the daytime that we did that.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, the other was too, but anyway, the charges in Hagaru, we had a lot more ammunition there. The engineers battalion, the engineer had a squad of EOD people too, so it wasn't just myself and my three men. Oh, yeah, I forgot to mention I had, at one time I had five, and the first day we went up to on the hill after the Chinese, the two of them were wounded the first day, and I was on the line for over 24 hours before I had any relief at all. So, but that's the way it was, and there were two army battalions. They came in, and they were mechanized, all mechanized, and they were up on the east side of the reservoir. The Marines, the two regiments, were on the left side, and we were at the base of the 32nd Battalion. The first night was completely overrun because they had Korean soldiers, and they would put them out at night, and then they crawled in their sleeping bags, and they were overrun. It just turned out that the story in the book there, too, that they just ceased to be a fighting organization. They were completely overrun. They were coming out on the reservoir, which, of course, was frozen, but our transport one in charge went out with trucks and picked up stragglers, and some of them had frozen feet, completely frozen black. So we saved quite a few of those. And about 7-8 years ago, I was still living in San Marcos. I came out one day, and my license had a plate around it, chosen few. This man was standing there, and he said, "Is this your car?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, I'm one of the army that you saved." So... that's just kind of touching. It. He said, "I was going to stay here till you came." So the Marines were able to pick up stragglers all the way down. They were in really bad shape. We were evacuated from Ham Hung, went back down to Pusan, and then started back up. And that was in January. And so I was there until July. And then it was just a continuation of the same thing, although we were never in the same critical condition we were before. We fought six major battles before I left, and there's an award called the Presidential Unit Citation, if you've heard of it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I got one for Guadalcanal or Gavutu, and two for Korea. So I have three Presidential Unit Citations.
What was it like when you came home from Korea after everything you'd been through, and you got to see your wife and daughter again?
Yeah, it was great. My wife stayed there, and she could have gone back east and stayed with her family, but she decided to stay there and get the house built. And I left her with, as I said, we love dogs, and we had a boxer that was pregnant. And so a night before we left, I guess two nights before, I decided that we took her out and we ran her up and down the beach for about an hour. And she had her puppies that day. So I was able to cut the tails and leave her with 10 dogs and a daughter. So she managed. I mean, she was really great. She stayed and saw the house built. She moved into the house, the first one to move in. And this is when she'd already had the word what was going on you know, the situation I was in. Some of the battalion was in the rear. The word got down to her to be expect the worst because they didn't really expect us to make it.
Wow.
So she was living with that for
a
while. And so she was really a wonderful girl and handled it. So then we met in San Francisco and came back down.
I've got a couple more questions.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and, you know, I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country and for sharing this story with us. As you approach your 100th birthday, what would you say you're most proud of?
Well, I guess I'm just proud of what we were able to accomplish. And but the fact that we were married 73 years, I think, is also a wonderful experience. And I'm proud of that because we were always happy. And even though we had separations, we were separated for about 3 years altogether.
Thanks to Uncle Sam.
Yeah. My wife was able to handle everything, so I just felt that the actor wrote a story. We were blessed, and that's what I felt. So after she died, I was encouraged to write a book, and that's what I did.
Picture of Vic and Skippy. We were blessed. Well, and speaking of, I don't want to be melodramatic, but I'm sure this is something you've given some thought to. Here you are, your very first day of combat in World War II. You're wounded, and the guy next to you is killed. Have you ever felt, though, that that wound at that time saved your life?
Well, I'll be honest with you. We were both very active at our church, Episcopalian Church, and I just felt that all the things happened that I was really blessed. Well, for both of us were. That's the best I can say.
You have any advice for the rest of us who might want to make it to 73 years of marriage or age 100?
Well, you know, it's funny. A lot of people have asked me that story, say, why? I said, well, I always get the last word. Yes, dear. My wife was not demanding. She was unusual. She did things that otherwise didn't do. She did her own hair. She didn't like to go to have all that done, her nails, and so she was very, very economical. And so I was the one who was a spender to buy her things. She never asked for anything. We never bought anything on time except real estate, of course.
Uh-huh.
When we bought the house. But if we couldn't afford to pay cash for the car, we just didn't buy it. We paid cash for everything except homes, of course. So that's another thing I try to convince people of, especially young people today.
I saw a picture of you coming home from the Honor Flight with our friends from Honor Flight San Diego. You flew from San Diego to Washington, D.C. to see the National World War II Memorial, which has the gold stars representing 406,000 Americans,
right,
including 30 of your guys in your battalion on your day of combat.
First day, did I mention that James Crist kept track after there were only 38 of us who wrote the book? And he would call me every August. And last August, he called me and said, well, there were two others that I just have not been able to get in touch with. So as far as he's concerned, I'm sole survivor of the original battalion, the first parachute battalion that landed in Guadalcanal.
You're the last one alive.
Yeah.
So those who died, you know, more than 400,000 Americans in World War II, more than 50,000 in Korea. You served in both of those.
Right.
How should we today remember those people? What was the significance of their sacrifice?
As far as I was concerned, I only did what I was expected to do, and that's all. I mean, people say, oh, you're a hero, hero. Well, the real hero to me were the corpsmen, the fellows who would come when you were wounded. They'd come and expose themselves and take care of you. Those were true heroes, and they'd expose themselves to take care of the wounded.
Mm-hmm.
What more can you expect than that?
What a treat to spend this hour with Vic Freudenberger. Looking forward to birthday number 100 at the end of January. There were some additional memories of Vic's that we couldn't quite squeeze into our radio time, but they are included in the podcast version of this episode at hometownheroesradio.com. Thanks so much for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, And then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that honor flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.